myself, the planner, the teacher. I would like to thank our outstanding staff, Michael Moore, Brad Holley, the staff, Alex Brozek, for moderating today's meeting and making this meeting possible. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take the time to sign up your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Today, we will have the first hearings and public testimony on three bills. They will follow in order. First, we will hear HB 168, electronic application for student benefits, offered by E-Rex Center. We will have HB 103, assisted living rooms, house rules by request of the governor, and SB 21, licensed mobile intensive care units, as Senator Reba. With each bill, we will hear a brief presentation from the sponsor, a subsequent analysis, and then a final testimony. In the interest of time, I think we wish to hold the questions until after the invited testimony. Oftentimes, a lot of questions get answered in that process, and then we will open up to questions from the committee. So, our first order of business is HB 168, electronic application for student benefits. Division of Public Health, Division of Public Assistance Director Shonda O'Brien will be on the phone for questions after the presentation. I will now take a brief introduce to hand it over to Co-Chair Zapowski for the presentation on HB 168. Thank you. economy is 2006 and possibly earlier, that's what we were able to find in our research. And we're currently just one of a small number of states who don't yet have the online application. But it seems like we'll be joining other states who are going to be doing this as well. And I think it's worth noting, it's been highly interesting with the pandemic, that online options for all state essential activities are critical, especially when we're talking about a state as large and diverse as Alaska. But even before the pandemic, adding online submission options has been a trend because it addresses two other motivations of this bill. The second in the series of three that I promised being removing barriers to access, and the third receiving the program efficiency. So the second issue, the motivation of this bill, the removal of barriers to access, and the purpose of these various programs, these public assistance programs, are to help the Alaskans get the right kind of life, get them onto a path of improved self-sufficiency and wellness, and the fewer barriers we can get in front of that path, the faster we can get folks on that path to achieving the positive outcomes that we're looking to support with these programs. And in some instances, these barriers may not seem very large, but they can be a big deal. So when we're talking about the availability of a printer, which would be required because you cannot sign online, it's required to provide a signature for these applications. And of course, in our world, there is going to have more issues with the consistency and frequency of postal service, and it adds excess time in terms of submitting the applications and for getting those applications reviewed. And that leads us into our third kind of motivation for this bill and for the division to be getting these applications online right now to improve efficiency. So I think it's surprising when we say that paper processing can be slow and that these up staff time unnecessarily. And as we've seen in previous years, it's contributed to a very big backlog and long waiting times. And while the division has made some excellent progress in improving the situation, we think that having this online option will make it more likely that this progress can be made permanent and be more sustainable. I think it's important to also highlight that the governor's budget is banking on the efficiencies that these online applications will provide. And again, as you might recall from our budget subcommittees, his budget included cuts of nearly $1 million in anticipation of reducing postage for mailers and supplies, and the elimination of dozens of positions, again, that would not be necessary with these online applications. So, let's see what else. We have not yet received a useful note, but as soon as that is supplied to us, we will be sharing that. But I think it's also important to recognize that that was built into these budget discussions because this is a plan that the division is working on. So, in summary, HB168 puts the current modernization work of the department into statute, and the additional online submission option for public assistance will remove barriers to access and improve processing efficiencies, saving money and time for the state.
Okay. Mr. Foley Road, and we've had many questions after their testimony. So we will be doing what Brian would say, Director of the Executive Policy Council. If you can begin to create your single hearing card and give your testimony.
Hey! Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you great.
Okay, sorry.
Many other things they're working on, they're also working on some alternative signature options, like an e-signature or a telephonic signature. And I'll also mention that we have recently received a waiver from USDA that is specific to COVID flexibilities, but that are allowing us to be authorized representatives and basically sign on behalf of clients that aren't able to, you know, see us in person. But because it's tied to COVID, you know, we don't know how long that's going to last. So these are all really important flexibilities to continue, because I think the more options, certainly, the better. But I'm just going to kind of speak to how the situation has been. So obviously, COVID, you know, we have many DPA offices closed, and certainly there are many offices, or many communities statewide that don't have offices, so don't really have a way to get a hold of the application necessarily. Some clients don't have access to the PDF application that's online. Some don't have printing or mailing capabilities, as was mentioned. And some just need help walking through the application and understanding, you know, the questions that are asked. It's a 28-page application, so it's quite long. So often we're having people over the phone, we're asking questions of the client, filling out the application on our end. And then if they don't have printing capabilities, which many don't, we then mail the application to them, and we provide a prepaid stamp return envelope. The client then, you know, receives it in the mail, reviews it, signs it, and then mails it back. When we're working, you know, with rural communities in particular, of course, this process can take quite a while. It can take weeks. And we've also found that many times it doesn't result in a submitted application for one reason or another. So there are a lot of challenges with this process. And I know that if some of these clients had access to internet and could self-submit, even with guidance from us over the phone, that would be a great option for them, and it would save a lot of mailing time and associated costs, you know, because those are costs that we have as well. Another benefit of a home application is it can be used to simplify the application for clients. So right now, clients can apply for multiple benefits at the same time using that GenPPC, you know, which is a great benefit to the client, of course, if they want to apply for those multiple programs. But, you know, the result, of course, is quite a long application, and some of the questions are not always relevant. And it can just be a lot for clients to wade through. When our outreach team helps clients, we know what questions are required and which ones aren't, so they can kind of simplify what can be, you know, sometimes a daunting process for clients. I think an online application can be made predictive, so it could allow clients to just answer the questions that are relevant to the programs they're applying for, and can even provide further explanation of the information needed. So, just in conclusion, you know, we're very supportive of an online application. I think this is great because it just supports the work the division's already put into this and is already doing, and we'll be really happy to see that option for clients in the future. Thank you.
Is that what you're looking at, or are you going to
structure. What's your thoughts on that?
Yes, I would. If I could say one comment before we turn to Director O'Brien, I think at the end of the day, we are mostly interested in whatever is necessary to create an efficiency. So I hear you observe part that. The language that is in there now came at the recommendation in talking with the department and legislative, but for the specific needs, certainly not the IT expert. I will turn to Director O'Brien. Director O'Brien, do you have a question?
Make sure that our documents are consistent and also particular teams that I think are really constructive are looking at that motivation from Google Assistant. And if you take over the last couple of pages, which includes their registration for information and how it's like a 24-page application, which some people may not understand that I need to fill out every single page of it. So I've been finding a way to streamline that. Makes a lot of sense, and we can have apply for Medicaid online at myalaska.gov, and so we're doing some of that work there already. You mentioned USDA, so is there any provisions in the American Rescue Plan Act that might be able to be used for this as well? Some problems here. You mentioned that we're going to need to apply to USDA for potentially for a waiver. The USDA requires an email, is I think what you said, for an application, and that we could potentially apply for a waiver USDA or any other programs that would require some special permission from the federal government.
If you can't communicate with people because they don't have an email or maybe there's some type of need, is the USDA giving us some solutions to that?
Yeah. Process. Thank you.
children's services and the Department of Health and Social Services, then Craig Baxter, the program manager, research and licensing, healthcare services, Department of Health and Social Services. As a reminder, we'll continue with upcoming questions until the end of the presentation. Director Beasley.
Commissioner, this is from the record. This is Dr. Gallagher from the doctor's union at the Body Services. The director is just back to the doctor's union itself. But so keep in mind that last of the messages, the last of the statutes that are on the federal regulations that require the state body service provider to get people who are laborers with city access and to a community that they would work out of labor.
So I guess with this change, what an assisted living home that is outside of assistance from the state or federal government, would that, would these new, I guess, requirements be, I guess, the ability to require it?
What if you had?
What if you had?
What if you had?
So are they requiring or currently to, I think this language here in section 2, that for assisted living homes, are they already, I guess, required by law? I mean, individuals' rights for gross money on their own can't be abridged, but I guess, like, strangers, you know, I understand that with money comes strings, but if a home is designed to be going in a different direction and not receiving those monies, why should there be, I guess, having a little bit of strength?
Yeah.
Is
recognize puberty, it is actually a blessing for others, but it is a blessing. Any message of my teenagers really don't feel my fault about my sentence encountered. But I am wondering if the department considered any additional provisions in this bill as recommended by the National Long-Term Care Advisory. The annual report was issued in the term October 1, 2019, to September 3, 2020, had several recommendations in it. There are in this bill, I'm very curious as to whether or not they were considered to be valid. They include the right to access to the internet, which I think is for like a utility and a right that would have to be been pretty ubiquitous, even in the library, and should be able to have a broken. Have a right to receive information in a language that the resident understands. Have the right to receive meals that are culturally preferred. And then the right to know that there is a proposal or retaliation. Do you consider any of these specific provisions regarding this bill? And if not, why not? Staff, and again, we'll be presenting the
are available on the phone for questions. We have Brian Webb, Emergency Response Manager, and Clint Farr, Operations Manager with the Division of Public Health. I'll be back to look for questions until the end of the presentation. So thank you. We're already here in front. Thank you. And you may put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Yes, thank you, Patricia. Good afternoon, members of the House and House Committee for Robert Senior Josh Goodman, District 1 South Anchorage. I really appreciate you joining SB 21 today. There are approximately 600 paramedics licensed in Alaska, and the paramedics licensure oversight is currently split between two separate agencies, the State Medical Board, which is under Commerce, and the Emergency Medical Services, which is under HESS. So the purpose of SB 21 is to help our paramedics by consolidating the emergency medical service system under one single agency, HESS, to improve beyond professional oversight. It has been unanimously supported by the medical board and has broad support from all kinds of first responders and paramedics around the state. What this will do is transfer all paramedic licensure to the Alaska Emergency Medical Services Office in HESS. Currently, paramedics are the only one of their kind under Commerce. The rest of all the other emergency medical services are already under HESS. Currently, responsible for certifying all the EMTs and intensive care paramedics. So, SB 21 will change this and open practice, the licensure requirements, or the fee structure. The medical director will be provided by the existing DHSS Chief Medical Officer and the EMS Medical Directors Committee. SB 21 will have zero fiscal impact, and HESS's existing data systems are already able to incorporate paramedic licensure, making it a seamless transition. Aligning all EMS services under a single agency promotes public health and safety goals and providing efficiencies through peer and professional oversight. It has bipartisan support and passes Senate for unanimously. Again, I appreciate you on the other side here.
Thank you, Mr. Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, simply that staff was never needed. Section 1, to remove the acquisition of paramedic licensure from the medical board. Section 2, allowing paramedics to practice medicine their own emergency life-saving service under another law instead of under the medical board's authority. Section 3, to remove paramedic section 4. The change for paramedics license under the medical board prevents us as under HESS for healthcare providers who must report certain injuries to the paramedic public safety. Section 5. The change for paramedics license under the medical board prevents license under HESS. Section 6. To allow paramedics to provide emergency medical care. Section 7. To require HESS to adopt regulations establishing standards for paramedic licenses. Section 8. To add regulation of paramedics licensure to HESS. Section 9. To clarify that HESS is the central certifying and licensing agency for emergency medical services. Section 10. To prohibit a person from practicing as a paramedic within a license. Section 11. Adding a third license provides similar individual license or certified emergency medical providers. For providing emergency medical service. I am not liable for civil damages in license or negligence. Section 12 is a method to clarify a paramedic is allowed to pronounce someone dead in certain circumstances. Section 13, to add the definition of mobile intensive care paramedic. Section 14, to include mobile intensive care paramedics in the municipal property tax exemption. Section 15, to add fees for licensure of paramedics in the list of fees collected to HESS. Section 16, remove emergency medical life-saving service in mobile intensive care paramedic. Section 17, amends the unclassified limit to provide transitional authorities. Section 18, provides an immediate effective date for HESS to adopt
questions are given for that section of analysis. Before we turn to questions from the committee, I also want to highlight there's not invited testimony today, but in addition to the two names I highlighted first, Brian Body, which is response manager, and Craig Shaw, operations manager with the Division of Public Health, who are available for questions. They're also the group we have Allison Natcher with the Department of Health and Social Services. We have Todd McDowell, manager of the Office of EMS. We have Dean Wiseman from RCHS. And we have Sharon Walsh, Deputy Director of the CPL.
Most licensing for healthcare professionals is done over in ABCC ED, and this seems to be that there's an exception here, and she can consolidate licensure for EMTs and paramedics in one spot. Is there a reason that you chose to go with HEST rather than the state brand of ABCC ED?
Yes, our representative Sparkles. So all the EMS services are already housed under one roof over in HEST. So the reason that they were split between the two was because of the time of when each of the journal permits were created. So this is kind of a cleanup measure. It's caused us some significant challenges to some of their licensure. And so the medical board has kind of had some challenges in the past, and maybe some licensing to it, but it's really clear. So that's kind of why we're moving in with the rest of the risk controllers. And the only EMA service that doesn't have a house.
Following I'm reading the history of Paramax and Alaska, and here it is where it describes how it was created over. The history of this was created, and the question is really, and I'm sure the rationale for moving Paramax over underneath the medical board. I mean, it used to be in the old days, everything was under the medical board, and now we've realized that healthcare providers are different, who have different expertise, can regulate. And manage their own licensure, which I think makes a lot of sense, and I think the paramedics should be allowed to do that. But most healthcare licensure, most licensure in the state of Alaska is actually done over by BCCED. And the choice is being made here to have paramedics move out of health as opposed to having EMTs move over to BCCED. And I'm just trying to understand kind of what was the reason, what was the rationale for doing.
Yes, Peter, so
that's
challenge things, looking at that, especially with education requirements and standards, procedures, and practice, it takes an advantage of BMS, but that won't get us exceedingly hard to do than for the medical board. Listen, we try for years to have a seat on the medical board, because there are only 655 paramedics in Alaska.
these physicians assistants, doctors, and other healthcare providers.
Yes, I guess one of my books was kind of like that and for the chat. Yes, there's a number of things that actually have been done. Some books have been spent, first things out to one of the other things, but the one that I'm trying to sort of that as well. And there's a number of things that are staying in this office and then some of that some of it when some of the paramedics know that give us some medical books. So there's a little bit of an uneven split there, but the vast majority of them have. And there's some books out from that university and staying in this office.
Thank you. Okay, I see no more questions. We will now move on to public testimony. We will limit public testimony to 2 minutes. I'm seeing two folks that are going to open public testimony. Ms. Wilma Benton, are you on the line? So if you please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Responder being the intended territory, is that correct?
request of EMS. And if I could, Sarah, maybe to address that, because I don't think I fully understood your question earlier, Representative Spiegel's, but when we looked at this problem initially, the idea was, you know, we'd be able to fix it until it was broken kind of thing. We thought that this seemed to be the easiest path that made most sense since EMS is already really seamlessly under us, and so we thought that this just seemed like the most obvious, easiest fix from our perspective. So.
Yeah, and before we go further, is there sufficient funds that we do see just to close it up for our veterans at this time?
So, and maybe I can have that clarified by the folks from the department online, but this should not affect the student service in any way. That's our response.
There's someone from the department here to add to that.
Thank you.